Okay, so I'm the temporary chairman for the next speaker, Tomasz Gomboszy. I told you that there is a small change in the program. So instead of integrable quantum field theories, we will hear about space weather and space physics. And let me introduce Tomasz, who is a leading space plasma scientist with particular interest in numerical solutions and space in the space environment. And we know him well because he was working in the Central Research Institute, KFKI, of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. And while with the institute, he participated in space missions and already contributed significantly to space science, and also in the Intercosmos program at that time. And then in 1985, he joined the faculty of the space physics of the University of Michigan, where he was founded and led a group of faculty and students pioneering the development of a new generation of high performance CDMHD numerical simulation models using solution adaptive grids. This group has also developed the space weather modeling framework that couples state-of-the-art models describing the complex Sun-Earth system. I think we will hear about that maybe. And also he was involved in the Phobos program to Mars, the Cassini-Huygens missions to Saturn, the Rosetta mission, and the STREO mission to observe the Sun. While serving as chair of the Department of Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Sciences, Gomboszy led the effort of University of Michigan to join the Department of Energy Fusion Science Center in 2004. Among other distinctions, he was named the Konstantin Gringos Distinguished University Professor of Space Science. And following this promotion, he was awarded with the International Christian Birkenland Medal. And in 2020, with the John Adam Fleming Medal, and also was appointed as to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Space Weather Advisory Group recently. So, and last and not least, I would like to mention that he always had the career of young scientist, including many Hungarian colleagues. And Tomasz, the floor is yours.
Thank you. This really sounded like an obituary. I am not there yet. Thank you very much. Oh, okay. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm also very pleased that I speak the official language of this meeting, which is English with a very heavy Hungarian accent. I'm sure you will understand me much better than those German accents before me. I am, my only connection to Wigner, unfortunately, is that my Wigner number, which is the generalization of the Erdős number, my Wigner number is 2. One of my mentors, Professor Thomas Donahue, co-authored a paper both with Wigner and myself. Unfortunately, I am not a quantum physicist. I work with much larger scales, as I will show. I have a history at KFKI, RMKI, Wigner Institute. You know, the name keeps changing, the people are the same. So I was an ELTE physics major. I was hired as the first full-time space scientist in Hungary. And at that time, I didn't know anything about space science. According to some of my best friends, it didn't change. I was apprentice, scientific researcher, and all kinds of ranks at KFKI. I had my PhD, and the Hungarian system at that time combined all the stupidities of the German and the Russian system. So I was a PhD, I was a candidate of science, doctor of science. I was a postdoc at the Space Research Institute in Moscow. That's where I learned basically almost everything I knew about space. I was mentored by some giants of Soviet space research, early people like Konstantin Gringaus, who was my mentor at IKI. He is the one who built the beep beep for the first space Sputnik. I spent a year as a postdoc at the University of Michigan, working on the inner Venus mission. That was after my stint at IKI, at the Space Research Institute in Moscow, where I worked on the Venera 9 and 10, the first planetary orbiters outside of Earth. Using my Soviet and US connections, I initiated the Hungarian participation in the Vega mission, which was later overshadowed by bigger people. And I left for the US, and I'm still there, where I worked on many space missions. And if you are interested, I have websites and some articles and books that might be relevant. So today I'd like to talk about space weather, which is very different than Wigner functions. And space weather is basically conditions on the sun and in geospace or space between the sun and Earth that impact technological systems or human health and life. And all space weather is consequence of solar activity. So space weather research is basically the study of the sun, the interplanetary medium, and the magnetosphere that surrounds the planet. There are two major kinds of origins for space weather. One is solar flares, which are basically just sudden brightenings on the sun. It's an electromagnetic phenomenon. And the other one is coronal mass ejection, where when the mass basically throws up. The sun had too much wine last night, so now it's dealing with the problems. So why do we care about space weather? Because space weather impacts the fundamentals of modern society, technological society, like the GPS. You know, we rely a lot on our GPS systems when we drive, and you don't want to drive into a ditch instead of the freeway. Aviation, radiation safety of airline crew and press passengers. For instance, I have a friend at Lawrence Livermore who was flying from London to San Francisco, and these people have to turn in their dosimeters once every 2 weeks. He came back from London, turned in his dosimeter. Half an hour later, he got a phone call. Where the hell have you been? Pipelines, especially north-south pipelines, I'm sorry, satellite drags, spacecraft anomalies, communications. This is very important for all of us. My dream is that there will be a huge space weather event during the Super Bowl in the US, which knocks out all TV broadcasting spacecraft. Next day, my budget will increase 10 times. Power grid, one of the nicest things of space weather is the aurora, which is associated with it, and astronaut safety. And last but not least, of course, the science, the space plasma physics, which is very attractive and very, it's a lot of fun. Oh, wrong direction. So why should Hungary care? This is a map of geomagnetic coordinates, because as we know, the Earth's rotation and magnetic axis are not parallel. So I'm pushing all kinds of buttons randomly. Yeah, here's this. So Budapest is the same geomagnetic latitude as Atlanta, which is very interesting. It means that Hungary is much less prone to space weather events because the higher you go in magnetic latitude, the most likely that space weather will impact you. That's why the Scandinavian countries and Canada are the most prone to this kind of effects. Here is an example. In March of 1989, there was a major solar storm which knocked out the power grid in Quebec. You know, worse things can happen to a French-speaking state. There was no power in Quebec for 9 hours, and very interestingly, 9 months later, the birth rate went up. In the US, there were some outages, power outages because of space weather. And this just shows the major effect on the power grid comes from the fact that the high voltage transformers that transform the voltage up for long distance transport, these transformers can have the ground induced currents seep in, they heat and basically burn down the transformer. The main problem is that not the $20 million, what is the price of a transformer, but the 9 months, what it takes to replace one. This is a very big problem, especially in the US, but also Northern Europe. Space radiation is another very important thing, and I know that in the former KFKI, there was a space radiation safety group. This plot here shows the known space radiation sources from galactic cosmic rays, and the depth is proportional to the uncertainty. Now, this is a logarithmic scale where the tick marks are 5 orders of magnitude apart. So this yellow range here means a factor of 1,000 or more variability, which depends on the sun, of course. So there was a very interesting event that between the Apollo 16 and 17 mission in 1972, there was in August there was one of the largest space weather events, one of the largest radiation storm from the sun, and it turns out that if these lunar spacewalks would have happened during this storm, we would have the pleasure to bring back dead astronauts, which is not good for PR. This table shows the radiation doses coming from various sources, and Chernobyl radiation dose is somewhere near the top. The bottom line is that large space weather events, a single space weather event can basically finish an astronaut's career, because in the US there is such an agency that is called OSHA. It's the it's basically the Worker Safety Administration. And the OSHA limit, lifetime limit, is much less for an astronaut than the dose what you expect from a single big event, especially when the astronauts are in the spacesuit, which is only 0.3 millimeter of aluminum. So it's pretty darn dangerous. And that's the problem with any Mars missions, and the Mars mission is legally impossible in the United States today. because the expected dose exceeds the lifetime limit. NASA and ESA, of course, has a heliophysics fleet of many spacecraft which continuously observes the sun and the magnetosphere and the conditions in space. And the most important thing what we are observing is the solar cycle variation of the sun. This plot shows the SOHO typical images from 1996 to basically present day, 2020, and it clearly shows the 11-year variation of the solar cycle. And of course, the most likely time when large space weather events happen is during the declining phase of the solar cycle. So what causes the solar cycle? I think, no, I wanted the other first. Anyway, so this shows that the solar magnetic dynamo, as it evolves during the 11-year time, creates magnetic loops that breaks through the photosphere, that breaks through the solar surface. And parts of the loops emerge above the solar surface and become visible as solar eruption loops. And these loops basically represent the active regions. These are the ones that can erupt. And these are the origin of all space weather. Maybe if I go back the other, the reason, well, this other movie doesn't want to play. It hates me. It's playing now. So it shows that during the 11-year cycle, because of the differential rotation of the sun, the solar magnetic field basically winds up around the sun. And when it becomes messy enough, then it starts to emerge through the solar surface. And this is how the solar dynamo basically works. The first space weather event which was observed was in 1859, when Richard Carrington in England observed a huge solar sunspot group and a following eruption. And this was actually, up to the day, the largest space weather event ever recorded. The magnetic field in Bombay, today it's Mumbai, of course, decreased by something like 1700 nanoteslas, which is the largest drop ever observed. And this is at low latitudes. So the only technological system at that time that could be impacted by space weather was at that time the telegraph. So telegraphs actually during the height of the storm, as the local newspapers observed at that time, worked on celestial power for hours. They disconnected the batteries, because with the batteries the paper caught fire. They disconnected the batteries and the telegraph still worked for hours, which was very interesting. Now, there is another thing in 1967, and those of you who are old like me remember that there was a lot of tension in the world in 67, including the first Arab-Israeli, not the first, but the Six-Day War. And during the Six-Day War, tension was very high between the US and the Soviets. And in May, just before the Six-Day War, suddenly, and this was the time when the US basically fully implemented the early warning radar system, which was basically looking at incoming missiles from the Soviet Union. Guess what? In late May, there was a huge space weather event on the sun, and the US early warning system radars got jammed. 1967, when your radar, early warning radar, is jammed, it was a cause for war, basically. The Soviets were coming. But there, fortunately, there was a smart enough colonel in the US Air Force who said, well, wait, don't launch those missiles yet. We don't hit back to the Soviets. Let's see what is really going on. And it turned out that it was the sun. The Soviets had nothing to do with it. But frankly, we just barely avoided World War III. This is not a very well publicized event, but one of the scary ones. In 2003, in the month of October, during the month of October, there were 17 major solar flares coming from two regions. And this was the largest series of events ever observed. The largest event actually turned out on, it was a celebration. It happened on November 7th, when officially it was an X-28 event, where X means it's the largest class of flares, and this scale is like the earthquake scale. It's logarithmic. So X is the largest, and then the multiplier, the 28, means it's 28 times the limit of X. So this was a huge. Later on, it was reevaluated. It turned out it was an X-45. It's largest ever. Fortunately, it went perpendicular to the Sun Earth line. So it never hit us, but it did hit Cassini, which was about to enter orbiting Saturn. And Cassini measured at 10 AU some tremendous 3 or 4 orders of magnitude increase in radiation. So that was huge. Some Halloween storm anomalies. All spacecraft that were orbiting at that time were impacted during the Halloween storms. All. Not all of them went into safe mode or lost part of the instrumentation, but everyone was having anomalies. Now, my favorite ones, and these are just some of the major events. There were airline rerouted polar flights. The Japanese lost the whole spacecraft, and so on. That's a long list, but my favorite is, where is Marie? Here. Marie was a dosimeter on a Mars mission sitting on the surface of Mars, and it was supposed to be a pathfinder for future Mars missions. So it was supposed to measure the radioactive dose on the surface of Mars. And the Halloween storms knocked it out. Marie died. Never recovered. In the US, space weather policy evolved a lot since the 1990s. I was one of the first scientists who got interested in space weather. It was late 80s, mid 90s. Some agencies like the National Science Foundation and the Air Force got really interested. It took about, politics is always ugly and slow. So it took about a good 20 years for the US, for space weather policy to raise to the presidential level. And finally, there was the PROSPIC Act, which is a law in the United States, which basically instructs the government to research, forecast, protect against space weather. One of the reasons why this is so important and interesting is, this is where it comes back to basic science. I don't know how many of you heard about EMPs, electromagnetic pulses, which look very much like space weather, and electromagnetic pulses are high altitude nuclear explosions that can really knock out technology in a region. So that's pretty ugly. I'd like to talk a little bit about our own group at the University of Michigan. Space science at Michigan started in 1948 when the US captured a large number of V-2 rockets, so did the Soviets, and by executive order, the president ordered the V-2s to be used only for peaceful scientific reasons. So the V-2s were launched up to the upper atmosphere for atmospheric research. One of the early V-2s basically carried two Michigan instruments, and ever since our laboratory built some 40 instruments for visiting everywhere in the solar system. My group is doing space plasma space weather simulations. We developed the so-called space weather modeling framework, which simulates the plasma environment from the solar surface to the Earth's surface. We just call it sun to mud. It's a pretty efficient model. I just would like to show a couple of simulation results. This is a solar coronal mass ejection simulation impacting Earth. We did this sometimes in the relatively early 2000s. The scale is solar radii, and then it will expand as the simulation goes. This is a two-dimensional cut through a three-dimensional simulation using adaptive mesh refinement. 60 solar radii is where Mercury is. So the mass ejection expands. 210 is at Earth. Here you see the adaptive grid. We use 19 levels of refinement in this simulation, and it zooms into Earth, and you can just see how insignificant we are in the solar system. The scales are very much realistic. So this was a simulation of the sun impacting Earth with a visualization made by amateurs like our group at Michigan. In the early 2000s, the American Museum of Natural History in London, in New York, that operates the Hayden Planetarium, created a planetarium show called Journey to a Star. And they used 3 minutes of our simulations to show the impact of space weather on the solar system. And this, they used Hollywood style visualization and movie making based on the simulation that we made. And it just shows the difference between amateurs and professionals when it comes to visualization. Now, the movie that I'm going to show, because they used our data, we can use the video, but not the sound, because Whoopi Goldberg was narrating the planetarium show, and we are not allowed it. So what I did, I added some Hungarian music as a good Hungarian, and I always challenge my audience to name the music. Now, in this audience, if I challenge you guys, I'm sure that half the audience will just stand up and shout at me what the music is. So here we go. Is the... And during the run of this planetarium show, several million people visited and saw this. Can you hear it? Can you recognize it? At the time when this movie was made, I was also an interdisciplinary scientist for the Cassini mission. So we continued the simulation out of Saturn because I wanted to kill two birds with one stone and basically use this material as PR for Cassini. And they actually used it quite a bit. So we go down to Saturn. Another interesting tidbit is that the American Museum wanted to be so realistic that they got the blueprints for the Voyager spacecraft. So this is as realistic as it gets. Okay, so which dances was this? Which one? No, six. I have it, but I don't remember. Good point. So, yeah. Yes. I really like the six dances. So how much time do I have? 3 minutes? Oh. Okay, so I speed it up. Anthropogenic space weather is one of the dumbest things humanity ever did. After the Sputnik shock in 1958, a guy, Lawrence Livermore National Lab guy called Nicholas Christofflos suggested that if we create artificial radiation belts around Earth, it will fry the Soviet ballistic missiles. Dumbest idea I ever heard. And but of course, nothing is dumb enough for the US military. So they decided to test it. And one of the most interesting, and then of course the US started the tests, the Soviets followed because They never wanted to stay behind. And the whole nuclear testing basically culminated in Starfish Prime in 1962, July. It was over the Johnston Islands. They blew up a 1.4 megaton hydrogen bomb at 400 kilometers. And that created something that was completely unexpected, the so-called EMP, the electromagnetic pulse. It didn't fry the Soviets, but it knocked out telephones and radio 1,500 kilometers away in Hawaii. And it turns out that this electromagnetic pulse, this one, when we compare it to a lightning, the lightning peaks at around 1 microsecond. And that's, you know, this is logarithmic scale. This is 10,000 volts per meter. So this is pretty significant. The EMP peaks at a tenth, at about 10 nanoseconds. It's so fast that there is no, and it's so fast because of the relativistic effects. And it's so fast, there is absolutely no way to have fast enough circuit breakers. So it will fry pretty much all technology. Again, I don't want to go into details. This shows the globe-wide impact of the Starfish Prime. It was really global. That's the takeaway message. Some impacts on technology, a power grid will go. There will be no cell towers. So the fact that your phone will fry doesn't make a difference. Cars will stop working because nowadays all modern cars have electric circuits, computers, basically. Pacemakers, if it's not a Faraday cage, it will fry and kill. And airplanes will follow the sky, except the very old ones, because the modern airplanes have all electronics controlled. This just shows the radiation belt. This is what Christofalos was talking about. The upper half is the radiation belts in November 62, so a few months after Starfish Prime. And this is the lower part is from the Van Allen belts, Van Allen probes. It's, you know, 2015. You can see that the whole inner radiation belt disappeared. But it took tens of years for that, the result of human stupidity, to disappear. This is the impact circle of an EMP. And the circles are by the altitude of explosion. So a nuclear weapon like Starfish Prime at 400 kilometers will impact the whole United States, one single one. And if I put Hungary on the map, even a 30 kilometer one will wipe us out. So the last question, is the sun or humanity more dangerous? And you decide. Thank you.
One question. You showed the temporal evolution of the EMP. My question is, of course, this was certainly the modulus of this, but it has a phase. My question is,
to what extent is it alternating?
This is DC.
Einseitig oder zweiseitig?
This is DC.
DC, okay.
So this is a static background field. I mean, just look at it. This is minus 4 to plus 4, 8 orders of magnitude. It's huge. And we are completely unprepared, especially the European countries. So is the US. I'm not trying to say that we are any better there than anyone here.
So thank you, Tomáš. May we start?